It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. First, when you think about birding, you may think of people taking special trips near and far to see special birds, checking cool and rare species off their list. But our next guest says there's another way to appreciate birds. It doesn't have to cost any money, and we can start in our own yards and neighborhoods with some of the local birds we might take for granted. It's slow birding, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you make a point of identifying birds at home or in your neighborhood? Do you have a bird feeder in your yard? Do you spend time watching what goes on there? Do you go to the park with the intention of observing birds? Do you have a list of birds you've seen, hope to see? Do you have ones you watch over time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Joan Strassman is the Charles Rebstock Professor of Biology at Washington University in St. Louis. Her new book is called Slow Birding, The Art and Science of Enjoying the Birds in Your Own Backyard. Joan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Now, I'm not a birder myself, Joan, but I got to say, I do like being out and seeing a majestic, you know, bald eagle or sandhill crane or something that's unusual. Slow birding is pretty different, though. Can you talk about the basic idea of what you mean by slow birding?
So slow birding is kind of like slow food, which was a movement started in Italy in response to fast food invading their country. The way I think about slow birding is that there's so much known about the birds that are all around us. If we just connect with them a little more closely, listen to their songs, watch what they're doing, that we can get the kind of enjoyment that some people might get by burning carbon and going many miles away, right in our own yards and neighborhoods.
There are a lot of birds featured in your book, and a lot of them are not, I think, the rock stars of the birding world, robins and wrens and many blue jays, ones we might see all the time. Can you talk about what we can gain, though, if we start watching them and learning about their behavior and what it is those little birds are doing?
So every bird has its story. All of the birds in the book are common in your listening area. And they're just really fun to watch. They fight, they mate, they find a partner often for life, and they just do lots of very cool things that we can enrich our own lives by learning about.
And you feature the work of scientists and bird behaviorists who are, you say, the slowest birders of all, people who really watch birds over a long period of time. What can looking at some of their understandings of birds tell us? How could it inform us and enhance our appreciation of those birds?
Well, I just think there's so many amazing little things that people have figured out. So just to pick one example, right now we've got the dark-eyed juncos have come down from their breeding grounds further north, and they're under our feeders and all around. And Ellen Ketterson at Indiana University and her collaborators figured out that they lose so much weight overnight, it would be the equivalent of a 160-pound person losing 11 pounds just overnight. So isn't that amazing?
That is. We are talking about Slow Birding, a book by that name by our guest Joan Strassman. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you keep tabs on the birds in your yard, in your neighborhood? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Dale is with us in River Falls. Dale, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, who are you watching?
I am absolutely crazy. Ask my family and my neighbors about my work from home project has been studying crows.
Oh, okay. And so you've been working at home for a while. What kinds of stuff are you learning about the crows in your yard?
Oh, don't even get me started. So first of all, I'm learning, you know, it took befriending them and actually getting to a point where we had a certain call that we would exchange, learning tons of things about the things that they love to eat, just crazy behaviors, seeing the mated pairs, et cetera. It's just incredibly fascinating.
Dale, thank you so much for sharing that. A great example, Joan. He's been watching those crows for quite a while. He's doing some slow birding there.
That's awesome. I love crows.
Yeah, and that brings us into the tactics. A lot of your book is suggestions about ways we can interact or observe birds in our backyard. Can you give us a couple starting tips, whether it's Dale's crow friends or otherwise?
So I would start by simply sitting in your backyard, on your balcony, in a nearby park, somewhere that has some natural vegetation, maybe with a cup of coffee or whatever it is you like to drink, and just listen. Pretend you're like a toddler just learning to speak. Try to hear all the sounds that you can. Open yourself to the experience and just try to decide which sounds might come from which birds. Because so often people start at a place that's really halfway through to the learning. I like to start at the beginning with sound, also with observation, but there's just something profound to me about the sound.
Well, let's hear the sound of one of the birds you write about. It also happens to be Wisconsin's state bird. Here is a robin song.
That's lovely.
Now, the story you share, the scientific story, I love this. This is one of my favorite stories in the book, and maybe all of us have thought about it. You see a robin with a worm in its mouth. How do they know these are worms underground sometimes? How do robins find the worms? You looked at some experiments to try to answer that question.
Yes, so they could hear them, they could feel them, they could see them, or they could smell them. And a couple of really fabulous Canadian researchers figured out the roles of all those different senses and found that hearing them was the first thing that robins do.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jed is with us in Couderay. Jed, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about, Jed?
Call. Well, I want to thank you for taking my call, and I just wanted to share a brief story. When I was a young child, my older brother took me out in the woods, and we sat down. He sat me down, and after 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, things really started to reveal themselves to us, including birds. So just in honor of him, and in, you know, you're talking about slow birding, but even just staying put and being comfortable in your surroundings, and definitely to sound as well. But this is from a long line of bird watchers. So peace and love to all birders worldwide, and to the birds as well.
Jed, great story. Thanks for sharing your origin story as a birder. And Joan, you talk about, you know, if we're in that position, we're in a backyard or the forest or whatever, you offer a couple different ways to kind of scan the scenery for birds. Can you share a couple ways we can approach that?
Yeah, so these are sort of classic animal behavior techniques where you can't really see everything at once, and that would be called ad lib, where you're just frantically trying to look everywhere and write everything down.
That's me.
And you realize you can't. So there's two other techniques. One is you just pick one bird. You watch that one bird for some certain amount of time. Maybe you take notes. Maybe you just watch it. And then you switch to another. So that would be called focal animal. And then the third technique is called scan sampling. And that is you just sort of look from left to right or right to left and just take a flash picture of what the bird is doing at the very second that you look at it and just tabulate up those for all the birds.
Thanks again for that call. We are talking to Joan Strassman, biology professor at Washington University in St. Louis. She shares many local birds with us here in Wisconsin. We're talking about her new book, Slow Birding, The Art and Science of Enjoying the Birds in Your Own Backyard. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. is this you? Do you observe birds in this kind of way? Do you consider yourself, now that you've heard the phrase, a slow birder? What do you see maybe in your backyard or in your neighborhood? Do you go to the same spot again and again and see who's there, what they're doing, what changes over the course of the day, over the course of the year? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Joan Strassman, professor of biology at Washington University in St. Louis. Her new book is Slow Birding, the Art and Science of Enjoying the Birds in Your Own Backyard. And you could join in at 800-642-1234, maybe with your own birding experiences or questions. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Karen is with us in Madison. Hi, Karen.
Hi, I just wanted to say I've been observing ever since, for about 20 years, since my dog died, and the squirrel kind of saved my life. So I've been observing birds and animals out my window a lot, and I found that if you're just open to the fact that they want the same things we want, we just, you know, become interspecial, you can see what they do. Like a blue jay flies out of a peach tree and goes up on a wire and rubs its beak. Well, they're using it like a napkin to get the oil off from eating the peaches and things like that. And when little birds are flying through the air like leaves because it's so windy and they're clinging to all my windows, I feel so sorry for them. They just want help.
Karen, thank you so much for sharing that. Karen is clearly a careful observer, Joan, but she also said something I thought was really interesting. She feels this connection with nature through her observations of these birds.
Yes, I think that's a really strong point of a big advantage of bird watching, because the birds are there because they want to be. They're wild. They can leave. They can fly away in ways that we could only dream of. They're just really fantastic to watch.
Karen, thank you so much for sharing that with us. We'll go to Jim now in Stevens Point. Jim, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Apparently, I've been practicing slow birding for 30 years, although I didn't know it. And I really look forward to a day like today when it's the first snow of the year, because I've been sitting here all afternoon and all morning, and I've had, you know, hundreds of birds. It's been just great. And I went out about halfway through the big feed, and they're all out there chirping and yakking away. So you get that part of the birds when you're out there, whether you're watching, whether you're inside. And the other thing I wanted to mention was that it kind of works toward how you garden, because I've gardened for 30 years in my yard, and I've created, you know, different layers and levels of bushes and shrubs and trees. And it all kind of works, and now they're here. So it's a wonderful thing.
Jim, thanks so much for sharing that. To his second point, Joan, you talk about that in your book, making your yard, your garden more bird-friendly when you can.
Yes, I do. I think hedges and that intermediate level is really important. And also, I'd just like to say that the classic work on Cooper's hawks was done by Bob Rosenfield at Stevens Point.
I was just going to get into that since Jim was from Stevens Point. I want to listen to the Cooper's hawk and then let's talk about him a little bit. And you spent some time in your book looking at the Cooper's hawk and that research you just mentioned in Stevens Point. Now, Cooper's hawk, we hear about DDT and bald eagles, of course, here in Wisconsin, around the country. The Cooper's hawk very, very dramatically cut back in numbers, in part because of DDT. Can you talk about that Wisconsin research you just mentioned based at UW Stevens Point?
Yeah, so Bob Rosenfield didn't really want to stay there for his PhD, and he hadn't seen a Cooper's hawk ever because they were so uncommon that he imagined they'd be in the deepest, darkest forests. But when he put ads in those little newspapers they used to throw in our yards, he found people were seeing them all over and that they were in suburban areas and that he actually had no trouble getting lots of Cooper's hawks. And he just did a fabulous study telling all about the Cooper's hawks, how they have plucking posts, how they have a long middle toe to snatch birds out of the air. It's just fabulous work. And it's just, I had such a wonderful time talking with him.
Thanks a lot, Jim, for bringing that up and giving us that place reference. That was a nice segue there. We are talking to Joan Strassman, biologist at Washington University in St. Louis. Her new book is called Slow Birding, The Art and Science of Enjoying the Birds in Your Own Backyard. Back to your calls now. Kevin is with us in Eau Claire. Kevin, hi.
Oh, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I discovered peanuts in the shell this year. And the blue jays' reaction to them has just been incredible. They'll come to the shell feeder and seem to find the very largest one first. They'll pick them up, drop them, get another one. And it's just been hilarious to watch. And then also had a Cooper's hawk outside my shop this morning, as a matter of fact.
Oh, nice,
and
Kevin.
The birds all disappeared.
I bet. Kevin, thank you so much for sharing that. You got a Blue Jay chapter. Now, peanuts aren't the only thing they'll pick up and share. Blue Jays may have helped plant oak tree forests around the country.
Yeah, it's just kind of something we don't often think of, that our northern landscapes are only about 11,000 years old. And before that, Wisconsin, Michigan, northern Missouri, it was all under, you know, miles of ice. And so as that ice receded, the forests actually moved north faster than you might think. And for the oaks, evidence is that the Blue Jays had a hand in that.
Yeah, so can you talk about, like, when we see an oak tree and there's acorns around it, some of the studies you reference in the book try to figure out, okay, how many of the acorns end up being snatched up and moved and maybe planted by blue jays? What kind of things are we finding out?
Well, so blue jays are major acorn predators, and they're also really good at picking the right ones. They can carry four or five in their esophagus at a time. They take the caps off. They sort of weigh them and don't take the acorns that might have weevils in them. So if you see acorns under a tree, you might check them out and see which ones you would take, whether there's lots with weevils, how easy is or hard it is to take off the cap. And then just think of those blue jays flying, you know, a kilometer, half a mile or more to cache them somewhere that they could then find them in the winter when there's less to eat.
Thanks for that call. Vivian joins us next in Green Bay. Vivian, hi.
Hi, two comments. One is I have a small urban lot, city lot, and I've planted things for pollinators and birds for the last 20 years. It doesn't take a lot of room. Just learn which plants will provide habitat and food. But we can learn a lot from the birds if we listen. If you hear a flock of crows being really noisy, start looking for a predator such as a great horned owl. I used to walk my neighborhood, and in the city of Green Bay, we have a lot of flat roofs in the commercial areas. Look at drugstore tops, big stuff. I used to hear nighthawks. They're not there anymore.
Vivian, thanks a lot for the call. All right, Vivian gives us a lot to work with, Joan. First of all, I've seen in our neighbor's tree crows freak out one time for an owl and one time just the other day for a red-tailed hawk in the tree. We can use birds as clues to see what else is going on in the neighborhood. Do you have other examples of that?
Yeah, the blue jays are the best signposts, and when they're yelling at something, it might be a very dark, deep tree that's really hard to see into, but sometimes it's worth spending the spending the time to see the, in my neighborhood, it would be a great horned owl hiding in there. And I agree with the caller about small lots. My city lot is only 50 feet wide, and so I've had to make every inch of it count.
Vivian also mentioned noticing changes. Now, one thing we can kind of do to level up our slow birding is to keep, you know, diaries of what we see hear and when we see it. A fellow by the name of Aldo Leopold actually developed a lot of good bird science here in Wisconsin doing exactly that. Can you talk about keeping journals and diaries of our observations?
So I just think it's really empowering to write down what you see and maybe to try to sketch the birds. But my very favorite way to do it is with eBird, and to just log your observations on the free app from Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. The reason I like eBird is because it is a citizen science project where our observations go into a bigger data set. And it also lets us explore. So I've also noticed I don't see as many common nighthawks as I used to see. And I could go into eBird and just put in, you know, explore common nighthawks, and then try to see if my observations fit the whole world's observations. So between eBird and the free app Merlin, which will identify songs and help you figure out what you're seeing, Those two apps are just fantastic.
Joan, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
It's been a pleasure to talk with you, and hello, Wisconsin.
Joan Strassman is the Charles Rebstock Professor of Biology at Washington University in St. Louis. We talked with her today about her new book. It's called Slow Birding, The Art and Science of Enjoying the Birds in Your Own Backyard. You can keep sharing your slow birding stories, by the way. If you'd like, you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email us, ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Being a fan of a sports team can be a source of joy when they win and disappointment when they lose. But it turns out, despite the ups and downs, having strong sports allegiances and connections may actually be good for you overall. In a series of interviews, surveys, and other research, our next guest found that people who are invested in sports teams tend to be happier, more open-minded, and have deeper, more rich social relationships in their lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What does being a sports fan mean to you? Do you have a community of people that you watch the big game, whatever the game might be, with? Friends, family, coworkers, whoever happens to show up at the bar that day? Let us know. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David Sikoriak is founder of Dexterity Consulting, a former executive at Madison Square Garden. He's co-author of the new book, brand new book, Fans Have More Friends. Dave, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you and your co-author, Dave, have been in the sports world a long time. What led you down this path of looking at the social and community benefits of being a fan?
Yeah, when we started working in sports, we began seeing this pattern of social relationships incentivizing the behavior. So, you know, I was working at the Knicks, and why would somebody be a Knicks season ticket holder, especially when the team is not performing well? Well, when you spend time with people and, you know, do ethnographic research, what you begin to see is there's a web of social relationships around. And so we were doing this, and we began seeing this. You know, we were studying baseball fans. We were studying NFL fans. World Cup came around in 2018. We explored that. And this pattern manifested over and over again, that The bigger fans had a lot of social relationships. So we're like, how can we test this proposition in a way to prove it out that this exists on scale? And we were, you know, not convinced that it would manifest on scale, but we devised an approach to test how big of a fan one is and how robust one's social network is. And long story short, what we found was the bigger fan you are, the more friends you have. And it's not only that. The bigger fan you are, the more you interact with those friends, the more you value those relationships. And then when we focused it on family, the bigger fan you are, the more you interact with your mom, your dad, your kids, your spouse, and the more you value those relationships. So on and on, we began seeing these, no matter how you looked at the measurement of your social network, you saw that bigger fans were really tapping into this. And this is the beauty of sports. It just gives you constant opportunities to engage with others, to have random conversations with a stranger, or have a heart-to-heart with your dad talking about the Packers beating the Cowboys on Sunday.
Now, what is it about sports in particular and not something else, our hobbies or whatever it might be?
You know, we are pro-social interaction. So if it's, you know, if you're connecting over yoga or woodworking, good for you. That's great. And you should do that because it's going to be healthy for you. The beauty of sports is it exists at a scale like no other.
Right.
Right. It's like, you know, we could talk about The Sopranos. You know, that's my reference point for a show that captivated us or one of the early shows back in the early 2000s. It doesn't compare to, you know, somebody having a conversation about The Sopranos versus having a conversation about this Sunday's game between Packers and Cowboys. It doesn't compare because sports exist at a scale that is unlike anything else. So you're likely to go into a bar and bump into a football fan. You're not likely to bump into a Sopranos fan or a Game of Thrones fan or somebody who practices yoga or likes to hike. They're possible. It's just you can't bank that one in.
Well, to that point, we heard from Joel on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Joel says, living in Green Bay, one is surrounded by Packers fans. Sports is a huge part of our local identity. The Packers bring much income to our community and do a lot of charitable work here and across the whole state. And Joel says, we greet each other on Mondays after a win with how about those Packers instead of hi, how are you? Now, Green Bay is special, but it doesn't have to be Green Bay, right, Dave?
You know, it doesn't have to be. And Green Bay is special there, but it is, you know, what it is just like a point of common connection that a community has that they can signal something and it could start a random conversation. So, you know, talking about the Packers game is an easy way in. I see somebody with a Cowboys hat, I could say tough loss on Sunday. And they're like, yeah, thank you. You know, again. But you know, those interactions are really healthy for us. Right. And the pandemic taught us that we miss those interactions with the people on the periphery of our social networks, the barista, you know, somebody you see when you're heading into work, all those kind of, you know, distant interactions that you can have the one-off hello are really healthy for us. And sports is a way that we can actually make those distant interactions much more fruitful.
Talking to Dave Sikoriak, co-author of the new book, Fans Have More Friends, about the social community benefits of being part of a fan community. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something you see in your own community, in your own life, in your family? Do you bond with people maybe in small ways, maybe in bigger ways over your team or your sport, whatever it may be? Call in and tell us about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dave, you see this as a solution to a couple problems. We hear again and again about an epidemic of loneliness in the U.S., of a lack of connection. COVID obviously didn't help that. You really see this connection we have over sports as being at least part of the cure.
I think that's well positioned there. It's part of the cure. It is what sports fandom does for you is create a sense of belonging. And loneliness is the opposite state of belonging. And again, it gives you belonging in a way that is not just with those close to you, but could be those in the community and could be complete strangers. That it gives you one kind of central place of identity that you can connect with other people.
And to that point, you share, you know, you're working with survey data, but you also did focus groups and one-on-one interviews with people. One of my favorite stories was someone named Jennifer, originally family from Kingston, Jamaica, came with her family to the U.S., was in middle school, I think in California, not fitting in, and saw some kids in jerseys, football jerseys. She had been a football fan. Quoting here now, I was like, you like football? They were like, dude, we love football. Who's your team? This one kid, Raymond, was like, the Raiders. And I was like, you're my people. I hang out with you now. And that really speaks to the ability of a lonely kid in that case to find their people.
Well, it is. I mean, you have me smiling because Jennifer is just a wonderful human and a great storyteller, and really comes alive in the book there. And it's such a basic way of looking at it. And, you know, fast forward to Jennifer, a grown adult, this powerful woman, multiple degrees, excelling in life. And she still looks back. It's like, yeah, you know, my relationship with my uncles when I came to this country were the seminal moments. They took me under their wing. They taught me Raiders football. They taught me how to throw a spiral. And that gave me the confidence to survive in, you know, as an immigrant, as a person of color, as a woman, on and on and on. These were kind of there were markers that she learned through just being able to interact on neutral ground with other people.
Okay, now another problem that we talk a lot about in the show, I was actually surprised to see it come up in your book, political polarization, where people kind of build an identity. I'm on this side, you're on that side, and so much of our identity then connects to that. Sports can be a way to cross cut. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, it's the biggest point of our book, and you know what we are most hopeful about of using sports fandom to help cure some of the ills of polarization. So we are polarized as a country, not that we have different political beliefs. That's actually could be productive. The problem is we have two separate universes of people that live different lives, that shop at different places, watch different TV shows, and rarely interact. Watch different news outlets and rarely interact with each other. And that what that does for us is it actually ratchets up the negative feeling, the hate towards other people. And what we saw various ways of looking at this is the bigger fan you are as a Republican, the less hate you have towards Democrats. So there's something used in political science called a feeling thermometer on a scale of 0 to 100, 0 being really cold, 100 being hot. So you ask Republicans how they feel about Democrats, they rate about a 20. You ask Democrats how they feel about Republicans, they average about a 22. But when you split each of those polls apart by how big of a fan they are, that moves from a 18 for non-fan Republicans to 27, or you know, we're in that range, and the same movement for Democrats. And really what's going on here is, to your point, a crisscross cutting identities. That we are living in separate bubbles. The one time those bubbles could actually intersect is around an NFL game, around a baseball game, around the World Cup that's coming up. These are moments that we are actually not Republicans, Democrats. We're Packers fans. Or I'm a Packers fan, you're a Cowboys fan, and we're going to be at each other, but in a very playful way. That never happens with our politics today. You cannot talk about that, but you can debate, if you're a Cowboys fan, what they should have done in Sunday's game. And you could debate that from being white or black or Republican or Democrat or Christian or Jewish or whatever it is. And those debates are perfectly, everything's in bounds.
We're talking to brand consultant Dave Sikoriak about a new book that he co-wrote. It's called Fans Have More Friends, looking at the social benefits of being a sports fan, part of a sports community. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do sports mean in your life? To your group of friends, to your family? Do a lot of your social relationships involve sports? Does it matter whether your team is good or not this current year, this current decade, if you're a Detroit Lions fan? Sorry, century. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Dave Sikoriak, brand consultant and former sports business executive who co-wrote the new book called Fans Have More Friends. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has being a fan of sports been a door opener for you in your social life, in your connections with other people, whether that's just a quick chat at the store or, you know, building whole rituals about getting together for the game? Tell us about it. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kevin is with us now in Janesville. Kevin, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. When I was a teenager, I discovered Australian rules football and tried to follow it for a while because ESPN was new and they had to fill their airtime with something. Years later, I met a man from Australia, which gave me an opening to strike up a friendship with somebody from half a world away.
Interesting. And Kevin, are you still following Australian rules football? Is it possible to do it now?
It's still possible. I tried to do it online. I've been watching at least the highlights and trying to keep track of who's who, but it's kind of hard.
Kevin, thanks a lot. But Dave, that speaks to, you know, this could be a way to reach out to people from different places and different cultures if we get into their sport. Might be obscure here. It's a big deal there.
Absolutely. And that's something Kevin had, like, sitting in his he had built up this social equity, mm-hmm. was looking to spend it. He meets somebody from Australia and it paid off and it was there. And that, you know, that's an extreme example there, but that exists, is paying attention to sports. You don't know when those opportunities come up. And the beauty of sports is somebody can signal that to you, that they are, you know, they're from Dallas, they're from Green Bay, and it opens up conversation.
Kevin, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Dave, I want to talk about, you know, being a fan of a bad team. I joked about the Detroit Lions a few minutes ago. I grew up in southeastern Michigan. I was used to sports-related suffering. You wrote about Cubs fans who had a long, long World Series drought finally end. I've been watching this show, Welcome to Wrexham, about a team at the bottom of the English football, the soccer system there. Is there something special about being that long enduring fan of a bad team?
Yeah, we often get the question of, like, some of this stuff is, you know, the bigger fan you are, the more friends you have, but it also, you know, works into well-being, that you're the happier you are, the more confident you are, the more optimistic you are, any kind of measure of well-being, we see a positive relationship with sports fandom. And we could credit that to the social relationship, not necessarily sports. So then we get the question of, like, well, what about those Lions fans? You know, so consistently bottom dwellers. And it works the same way. We don't see any difference from a data perspective. We don't see any difference in any kind of the friendship or happiness measures. And when you think about sports fandom, the beauty of it is it provides you a range of emotions to connect over, right? So the Lions fans do a lot of commiserating and a lot of complaining and a lot of venting. But venting is good for you. There's, you know, many aspects of life that we hold things in. With sports, you don't hold it in. Somebody asks you, what do you think of the Lions, and you're a Lions fan, you'll share. You'll vent. And that has a positive benefit. Somebody's listening to you, and you're able to let loose of something there. So sports, regardless, win or lose, provide you an opportunity to connect. And the reality is most teams lose at the end of the season.
Right.
There's one winner. So we all get to experience a loss and the jubilation. I'm a Yankees fan. And, you know, so we've had a lot of winning. But we Yankee fans are complaining now. We're itching. It's been 2009 since our last one. And so over the last 12 years, 13 years, there's been a lot more frustration at the end of the year for just in terms of connecting with other people. The frustration is just as valid as interaction that you can have as much as jubilation.
Now, I mentioned,
so we vote for jubilation. We choose it every single time, but that's just not the reality.
Now, I mentioned the Chicago Cubs there, and you talked, I think it was a father and son who had kind of grown up around the Cubs in particular, and the memories they had, it wasn't, you know, remember winning this game or that game. I mean, there's some of that, but remember watching it with the family, that kind of thing. Can you talk about how families use sports?
Yeah, so this is, Lindsay and Nick. Nick lives in Chicago. Dad lives in Central Illinois. So I met Nick in a focus group and then subsequently did an ethnography with him. And what I asked him was, like, you know, would you invite your dad up? I would like to meet your dad and hang out with the two of you. So we go to a Cubs game and it's just beautiful, right? You just talk about life. Where I talked about my kids, where I'm from. I'm from New York. I'm a Yankees fan. They talked about their family and their interactions and being a Cubs fan. And there was a moment that we talk about in the book of, you know, I asked his dad of being able to go in 2016 to a World Series game. And, you know, I was like, how was that? How was that feeling? And he just chokes up and doesn't, you know, he musters, it was special. And you know, what dawned on us, you know, in that interaction was it wasn't the World Series game. It was the 35 years or so, or however old Nick was at the time, of relationship between father, son, father and sister, the family unit that they had, that so much of their life was made up of the Cubs. Like Nick would say when I first met him, he said, the Cubs are, baseball is my family sport. That's what my family connects over. And they become signal for the years of a relationship. I mean, we have a quote in the book of, when he, you know, sees Juan Santo clicking his heels, he thinks of being at home as a kid sitting on his dad's lap. These are really rich memories that that sports, as much as anything else, really elicits in us.
We are talking about social connections we can make as sports fans and the benefits we get from them. Dave Sikoriak is with us, co-author of the new book, Fans Have More Friends. Still time for your story at 800-642-1234. A caller who couldn't stay on the line says, questions whether the friends you make, say, at the bar watching a game are really friends. Like, is there some value even to that casual connection you have? You and I happen to be sitting at the table next to each other, reacting to the game together?
Yes, 100%. We need all those types of interactions, right? So you need those close, intimate friends that you can share, you know, details of your life, your struggles, and those are really important. But it's also important to, hey, did you see that play? What's going on? Where are you guys from? Oh, you went to school here. Do you know that? And that might be it. But you, both of you, had an interaction with a complete stranger, predicated, you know, brought on by sports that are actually quite positive. So yeah, you might not everyone's going to be a lifelong friend, but every interaction can have a positive benefit.
Now I'm going to ask you for advice for people out there who might think, yeah, I like sports, okay, but I don't do this stuff. I don't get these connections. I don't talk to people about it. How can they leverage some of the work you guys have done to use sports to be more connected?
Well, think of someone in your network who's a sports fan, and invariably there's going to be people. You have somebody who's a Packers fan, pay attention loosely to the game. You know, they came back. It was a big comeback. How'd you feel? The beauty of sports fans, if you ask them a question about their team and have their opinion, they will talk. They will give you enough material and they'll actually feel good. It's like, oh, you know that, you know, Tyler's a real listener. He's great and asks great questions. So I think the start is just pay attention a little bit more. Understand. And if you have somebody in your life that is a fan, ask them about these things. You know, you get invited to, you know, go watch a game here. You know, we're hosting a party. Come over. Instead of the, oh, I'm not really a football fan or whatever, just go over. It's not about the football. It's about going there and hanging out and connecting with other people. That's really it. So see those opportunities as not a way to dive into the details of sports, which you might not be as interested in or might not know as much about. See it as an opportunity to connect with others. Me, a Yankee fan, if I met you, you ask me any question about the Yankees, I'm happy to explain. I'll go on and on. I can teach a college level course on the Yankees for you. And I'm sure there's a lot of Packer fans that feel the same way. A lot of Bucks fans that feel the same way about it. Cause we're proud of this. This is, you know, having a sports team is really built into your identity. And it's something that we, you know, we put at the forefront of who we are. So you're a non-fan, you meet somebody who's a fan of another team, ask them about it. Cause they're really telling you about themselves.
And people might think, okay, yeah, if I went to a cricket watching party, I have no idea what's going on. I don't want to like be the dumb guy in the room who doesn't get the rules of cricket. How can we overcome that shyness?
Yeah, one thing, as a fan, I've evolved through doing this research. People like Jennifer, you mentioned, really taught me a different perspective. You know, I didn't have the same experience as a Jamaican immigrant coming in here, or I'm not a Jamaican immigrant, so I didn't have that same experience. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we sometimes build up so much into knowing about or sounding stupid. And I tell you, as a lifelong fan, I'm 50 years old now, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. Even an innocent question is actually an opportunity that most sports fan would actually, you know, explain to you and not mock you as a result. They'd mock you if you're a Cowboys fan and have fun with you in that. But if you're coming in there and genuinely curious about something, I think most sports fans, you know, would actually indulge you on that.
Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's David Sikoriak, founder of Dexterity Consulting, former executive at Madison Square Garden, with us today sharing the new book he's co-author of. It's called Fans Have More Friends. If you have a story to share, there's still time. You could do it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Do you have a group of people you watch the game with, whether you're in person or across the country, maybe texting back and forth or talking about it afterward? How do sports fit into your social life and connectedness? Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.